now at the potluck part of our service. As we do on this Sunday, I invite people to bring any kind of a reading, poem, meditation, anything that's been especially meaningful to you over the years that you'd like to offer in this service as a new year comes. We have no set order. If you have something you'd like to read, maybe to move things along, if you'd like to just come and maybe, you don't have to do this, if you'd like to come and take a seat on the front pew here so you can read it and then return to your seat. So who's got something for us today? Surely someone does. Okay. Roy, you want to? You don't have to, just come from your seat. Forget what I said about the last thing. Roy, I'll let you lead it off today.
I have two things to read. And I was wondering what FDR had to say as he spoke to the nation in the midst of the Depression. And I was wondering about him, obviously, given the fact where we are today. And so I read his inaugural address. And I'm not going to read the whole thing, but it's the famous one about we have nothing to fear. But he said a lot more than that. So I'm going to read a few excerpts from it. President Hoover, Mr. Chief Justice, my friends, this is a day of national consecration. And I am certain that my fellow Americans expect that on my induction into the presidency, I will address them with a candor and a decision which the present situation of our nation impels. This is preeminently the time to speak the truth, the whole truth, frankly and boldly. Nor need we shrink from honestly facing conditions in our country today. This great nation will endure as it has endured, will revive and will prosper. So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance. In every dark hour of a national life, a leadership of frankness and vigor has met with that understanding and support of the people themselves, which is essential to victory. I am convinced that you will again give me that support to leadership in these critical days. In such a spirit on my part and on yours, we face our common difficulties. They concern, thank God, only material things. Values have shrunken to fantastic levels. Taxes have risen. Our ability to pay has fallen. Government of all kinds is faced by serious curtailment of income. The means of exchange are frozen in the currents of trade. The withered leaves of industrial enterprise lie on every side. Farmers find no markets for their produce. The savings of many years in thousands of families are gone. More important, a host of unemployed citizens face the grim problem of existence, and an equally great number toil with little return. Only a foolish optimist can deny the dark realities of the moment. Yet our distress comes from no failure of substance. We are stricken by no plague of locusts. Compared with the perils which our forefathers conquered because they believed and were not afraid, we have still much to be thankful for. Nature still offers her bounty, and human efforts have multiplied. Plenty is at our doorstep, but a generous use of it languishes in the very sight of the supply. Primarily, this is because the rulers of the exchange of mankind's goods have failed through their own stubbornness and their own incompetence, have admitted their failures, and abdicated. Practices of the unscrupulous money changers stand indicted in the court of public opinion, rejected by the hearts and minds of men. Stripped of the lure of profits by which to induce our people to follow their false leadership, they have resorted to exhortations, pleading cheerfully for restored conditions. They know only the rules of a generation of self-seekers. They have no vision, and when there is no vision, the people perish. Happiness lies not in the mere possession of money. It lies in the joy of achievement, in the thrill of creative effort. In our progress towards a resumption of work, we require these safeguards against the return of the evils of the old order. There must be strict supervision of all banking and credit and investments. There must be an end to speculation with other people's money, and there must be provision for an adequate and sound currency. We do not distrust the future of essential democracy. The people of the United States have not failed. In their need, they have registered a mandate that they want direct, vigorous action. So I'm going to read a little bit from Barack Obama now. And this is from Dreams from My Father, which he wrote in 1995. And it's his life story and his thoughts about his life and his African heritage. And towards the end of the book, he is in Kenya and he meets with his grandmother and she talks about the family history and so on. And then he's at the cemetery where his father and his grandfather, he's at the graves of his father and grandfather. And he's kind of talking to them and talking to himself. And the paragraph's a little obscure, but it's worth listening to just for the ending. I dropped to the ground and swept my hand across the smooth yellow tile. Oh, Father, I cried. There was no shame in your confusion, just as there had been no shame in your fathers before you, no shame in the fear or in the fear of his father before him. There was only shame in the silence fear had produced. It was the silence that betrayed us. If it weren't for that silence, your grandfather might have told your father that he could never escape himself or recreate himself alone. Your father might have taught those same lessons to you, and you, the son, might have taught your father that this new world that was beckoning all of you involved more than just railroads and indoor toilets and irrigation ditches and gramophones, lifeless instruments that could be absorbed into the old ways. You might have told him that these instruments carried with them a dangerous power, that they demanded a different way of seeing the world, that this power could be absorbed only alongside a faith born out of hardship, a faith that wasn't new, that wasn't black or white or Christian or Muslim, but that pulsed in the heart of the first African village and the first Kansas homestead, a faith in other people.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks very much.
You may have heard of an organization called Church Women United. It's a group of Christian women. One of the members once had the idea that it might be nice if an entire 24 hours were spent in prayer. Accordingly, members were asked to donate half an hour each around the clock in prayer. I was not a member of the group, of course, but a friend of mine asked me if I would contribute, and so because she was my friend, I said, sure. I did it for several years, and it was relaxing and kind of fun. But then I thought, oh, horrors, I'm sick of all these same old prayers and the same old readings. So Steve lent me a book on Unitarian prayers, which were very different. This is a prayer written by a not very well-known Unitarian. May we learn to appreciate our many gifts, beginning with the greatest gift of all, life itself. May we find peace, love, and contentment in our lives. When sorrow, adversity, even heartsick, threaten to overwhelm us, may we find the courage and the will to deal with each as best we can. And whenever we find another in need, may we be helpful in ways large and small. After a lifetime of living, may the glow of friendship, good times, love remembered, warm our days.
At about 9:15 this morning, I felt an incredible sense of gratitude. Let me explain. You know how parents always want to provide things for their kids that they themselves never had as a kid, like piano lessons? Well, as a kid, I attended a Presbyterian church with my parents, and I never felt a sense of community there. I never bought into the faith that they prescribed. And as an adult, I didn't even want to get married in that church, and I didn't. And yet, without conscientiously trying to provide something that I didn't have in terms of a church community, somehow it's happened. My kids have been given what I lacked in my childhood by this church. It was at 9:15 this morning that I went in to wake up Andrea, and she was adamant that she come to this service. Now, as a 16-year-old, I have no recollection of ever driving to a church service by myself. She was ready to come by herself. And I decided to come with her. She wanted to speak here at church as a 16-year-old. I never wanted to do that as a 16-year-old. I don't know what else to say, but I'm so grateful for this place. I'm so moved by seeing my children grow up and want to participate, and want to contribute, and want to receive.
That means Andrea is.
I heard this, I guess you could call it a song, 2 years ago, and I just thought it was so cool. I mean, I'd never really heard a song without a melody. I mean, but it had a chorus, and the rest was just spoken as if it was a speech that would be read at a graduation. Which, believe it or not, it actually was. Not quite sure where, but I don't think that really matters so much as like what this guy named Baz Luhrmann says. And I've listened to this so much, I make it a point to recite it to myself every month to see if I can, you know, still know it by memory, and if not, well then I gotta listen to it so that it is memorized. So this is the sunscreen song, and I gotta say, if I speak at my graduation, this is probably something that I'll go along the lines of saying. Wear sunscreen. If I could offer you only one tip for the future, sunscreen would be it. The long-term benefits of sunscreen have been proven by scientists whereas the rest of my advice has no basis more reliable than my own meandering experience. I will dispense this advice now. Enjoy the power and beauty of your youth. Oh, never mind. You will not understand the power and beauty of your youth until they've faded. But trust me, in 20 years, you'll look back at photos of yourself and recall in a way you can't grasp now how much possibility lay before you and how fabulous you really looked. You're not as fat as you imagine. Don't worry about the future or worry, but know that worrying is about as effective as trying to solve an algebra equation by chewing bubblegum. The real troubles in your life are apt to be things that never crossed your worried mind, the kind that blindside you at 4 p.m. on some idle Tuesday. Do one thing every day that scares you. Sing. Don't be reckless with other people's hearts. Don't put up with people who are reckless with yours. Floss. Don't waste your time on jealousy. Sometimes you're ahead, sometimes you're behind. The race is long, and in the end, it's with yourself. Remember the compliments you receive. Forget the insults. If you succeed in doing this, tell me how. Keep your old love letters. Throw away your old bank statements. Stretch. Don't feel guilty if you don't know what you want to do with your life. The most interesting people I knew at 22 didn't know what they wanted to do with their lives. Some of the most interesting 40-year-olds I know still don't. Get plenty of calcium. Be kind to your knees. You'll miss them when they're gone. Maybe you'll marry, maybe you won't. Maybe you'll have children, maybe you won't. Maybe you'll divorce at 40, maybe you'll dance the funky chicken at your 75th wedding anniversary. Whatever you do, don't congratulate yourself too much, or berate yourself either. Your choices are half chance, so are everybody else's. Enjoy your body, use it every way you can. Don't be afraid of it, or what other people think. It's the greatest instrument you'll ever own. Dance, even if you have nowhere to do it but in your own living room. Read the directions, even if you don't follow them. Do not read beauty magazines. They will only make you feel ugly. Get to know your parents. You'll never know when they might be gone for good. Be nice to your siblings. They're the best link to your past and the people most likely to stick with you in the future. Understand that friends come and go, but for the precious few, you should hold on. Work hard to bridge the gaps in geography and lifestyle, because the older you get, the more you need the people you knew when you were young. Live in New York City once, but leave before it makes you hard. Live in Northern California once, but leave before it makes you soft. Travel. Accept certain inalienable truths. Prices will rise. Politicians will philander. You too will get old. And when you do, you'll fantasize that when you were young, prices were reasonable, politicians were noble, and children respected their elders. Respect your elders. Don't expect anyone else to support you. Maybe you'll have a trust fund, maybe you'll have a wealthy spouse, but you never know when either one might run out. Don't mess too much with your hair, or by the time you're 40, it will look 85. Be careful whose advice you buy, but be patient with those who supply it. Advice is a form of nostalgia. Dispensing it is a way of fishing out the past from the disposal, wiping it off, painting over the ugly parts, and recycling it for more than it's worth. But trust me on the sunscreen.
Thanks, Andrea. Thank you very much. Thank you. Anyone else? Well, I will offer my piece, and then I'm going to invite you to all take part in a little something we'll share together. This is from a collection of writings by the Reverend Carl Scovel, now a retired Unitarian Universalist minister. He was the minister of King's Chapel in Boston for quite a number of years. Carl is someone I've admired, whose counsel and wisdom I've sought over the years. He's probably the most articulate spokesperson for the sort of the Unitarian Universalist Christian aspect of our movement, and while I didn't quite share his theology, I certainly, like I say, rely on his wisdom from time to time. He had a little radio show down in, or radio program down in Boston for a number of years, and he, I think he was just on for 3 or 4 minutes at a time, and he published a collection of writings from that program. This is one called How Can I Keep From Singing? The story behind a song sometimes tells the story of a people. About 40 years ago, the First Unitarian Church in Los Angeles published its own hymnal, a collection titled Songs of Faith in Man, which reflected their humanist philosophy. I bought a copy, and while playing my way through some of the easier hymns, I came across one the editor said he got from Pete Seeger, who told him it was an old Quaker hymn. Well, that sounded strange to me. I had sat with the friends on first day mornings for 2 years in college, and I knew that mainline Quakers rarely speak and never sing during the meeting. The name of the hymn in question was How Can I Keep From Singing? It has a lovely tune, and you can find it now in the Methodist, Disciples, United Church of Christ, and Unitarian Universalist hymnals. The UCC hymnal tells us that it first appeared in a collection called Bright Jewels for the Sunday School, published in 1869. I found it in Amor Dei, a Unitarian collection of hymns dated 1901. The tune is pentatonic, which means you can play it on the black keys of your piano, and the composer is Robert Lowry. The text comes from that prolific author, Anonymous. The New United Church of Christ hymnal has the same familiar verse as appears in the Los Angeles collection, but then reprints the old words that appeared in Bright Jewels. These tell us of God's help on earth and our hope of heaven. But the UCC hymnal retains one new verse, the third. And the notes tell us that this verse was written during the 1950s by an American, Doris Plenn, during the worst days of the McCarthy mania. During this time, many Americans lost jobs and friends. Some fled the country, some went to jail, and all because they were accused by McCarthy and his allies of being communist sympathizers, party members, and agents. Almost all of these people were tried and found guilty by federal and state committees that were the American equivalent of the British Star Chamber. Some of us remember what a terrible time this was. And we remember as well the few who stood against the tide of the times. Foreign service officials like Owen Lattimore, cartoonists like Walt Kelly, entertainers like, like Zero Mostel, ministers like Methodist Bishop G. Bromley Oxnam, and Don Lothrop of Boston's Community Church, and poets like Doris Plenn. Plenn wrote another stanza for How Can I Keep From Singing, which did find the hymn in the 1950s selection beneath his gaze, a mystery that stunned the imagination. Excuse me. That didn't sound right because I skipped a page. Plenn wrote another song for How Can I Keep From Singing. Where did she find the hymn in the 1950s when most hymnologists had never heard of it? I don't know, but she did find it. And here is her third verse. When tyrants tremble, sick with fear, and hear their death knells ringing. When friends rejoice both far and near, how can I keep from singing? In prison cell and dungeon vile, our thoughts to them are winging. When friends by shame are undefiled, how can I keep from singing? Thanks be to God for all the saints, including Doris Plenn.